I next met with Dr. Omid Hamid, and to begin, he commented on systemic management of basal cell carcinoma.
Most medical oncologists don't see a lot of BCC given the dearth of options and therapeutics available in the past. It's only been chemotherapeutics or a targeted agent like cetuximab without real scientific proof behind it, but just the need to find something. You know, basal cell carcinoma is the most common skin cancer diagnosed, 2 million cases a year, but the majority are surgically amenable, or local radiotherapy or a local topical will take care of it, and without any further issues in over 95% of the patients. But when it recurs, when it is multifocal, like patients with Gorlin syndrome, and when it becomes metastatic, we have not had an appropriate therapy until just recently. This is data that came out in the New England Journal with Dan Van Hoff in a phase 1 study of a hedgehog inhibitor, showing that it had great responses in locally advanced and metastatic basal cell carcinoma. And then further through the ArriVance trial, where we treated a little over 100 patients with locally advanced and metastatic basal cell carcinoma, we found that this drug, vismodegib, has not only a high response rate, but a good duration of response in these patients. And the reason behind that is basically what we've been looking for in almost every cancer, a target. And the target there is mutations in the hedgehog pathway in the patch and smooth, and these are found in over 90% of basal cell carcinomas. Just think about the other targeted agents and the preponderance of those mutations in those tumors. For example, the BRAF mutation is found in about 50% of melanomas only. But the basal cell carcinoma, the hedgehog mutation, is found in over 90%, which makes this drug truly a great option for a majority of those patients with recurrent, locally advanced basal cell carcinoma where surgery is not appropriate and radiation is not appropriate given the location, the toxicity, or the recurrence through those therapies. This drug has been able to allow us to treat those patients in patients who have Gorlin syndrome or xeroderma pigmentosum where radiation is contraindicated. It has shown in prospective studies to decrease the incidence of further basal cell carcinomas and decrease the morbidity from future surgeries. And not only is this a drug that's being used in locally advanced, but in metastatic patients, a good response and a good duration of response. And this is moving forward now, looking at it in a neoadjuvant fashion, the ability to have a benefit in cosmetics or in morbidity of future surgery. Those who have treated basal cell carcinomas in the past realize just the severity of surgical resections of recurrent basal cell carcinomas and the deformative surgeries done in the past.
So the efficacy findings in this pivotal trial are impressive. 30% objective response rate with metastatic disease, almost 50% in the locally advanced setting. Very impressive waterfall plot showing almost all patients with tumor decreased. Average responses 7 or 8 months. What about the toxicity profile, which seems pretty unusual in terms of drugs in oncology?
Familiarity with this drug is important as it has a different toxicity pattern. I've never seen anything like it. The side effects are alopecia. The side effects are what's new for most oncologists, dysgeusia or agesia, not anorexia, not the lack of motivation to eat, but a change in taste. And patients will say that things taste metallic or they taste different and therefore they won't eat as much. There is a cramping phenomena, muscle aches and cramps that has not really been worked to find the true mechanism. Patients will report cramping at night and even severe cramps. And it's not a cramping related to electrolyte abnormalities or hydration. And what we're looking through is trying to find ways to mitigate these toxicities. Vismodegib is given as a 150 milligram tablet once a day. And the way the pharmacokinetics work of this drug, you have to dose it daily. There is no dose reduction. So physicians like Dr. Sekulic at Mayo are looking at different regimens of giving it for a short amount of time and then giving some time off. But the understanding of the management of toxicity of this drug is also in rapid evolution.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because not too many people have experience with it. Overall, when you start a patient on this drug, in your own mind, what's the likelihood, A, they're going to completely cruise through it like a placebo, B, they're going to have some minor problems, but it's not going to be, you know, really a big deal, and C, it's going to be a major quality of life problem?
So it's the rare patient that has no toxicity to this drug. The majority of patients fall in the moderate toxicities of the cramping. The hair loss is universal for patients. And there is a rare patient who will need to come off for an extended period of time due to significant weight loss or the side effects of the cramping.
The taste thing sounds very unusual. Now, do they have that sensation when they don't eat or just when they eat?
More of the time with bismodegib, it's when they're eating. You know, they'll look at something and say, well, I remember that is good to me. That tastes good to me, or I like to eat that. And then when they put it in their mouth, it just tastes different.
I've heard stories of people who, you know, wanted to stop it for the Christmas holidays or whatever so they could eat. How long does it take to reverse this once you stop the drug?
It's got a short half-life. And remember that locally advanced and metastatic basal cell carcinoma is rare. So most physicians have, you know, a couple of these patients hanging around. But these toxicities can improve within a couple of days to a week. And I usually give patients a 1 week to 2 week break and restart them on the drug. I've been fortunate at times to have patients whose the grade of their toxicity becomes less and more tolerable. Let me make the point that basal cell carcinomas are not very high turnover tumors. Their growth kinetics are slow, and therefore the ability to give these patients the break and to return them to a baseline for an extended period of time is a more practical thing in these patients and a fairly safe idea.
Are there any other hedgehog inhibitors in development?
There are multiple different hedgehog inhibitors in development. Novartis just recently presented their data at ASCO 2014 with their hedgehog inhibitor, and this was the BOLT trial. This was in basal cell carcinoma showing similar response rates and similar toxicities.
You know, in other mutation situations, different mutations, we're seeing, you know, often we'll talk later on about BRAF and melanoma. Often targeted therapy only works for a, you know, relatively short period of time and then resistance develops. What about in terms of hedgehog inhibitors and vismodegib? What's the duration of response?
With all targeted therapies, resistance does occur, and we do see that with vismodegib. What I've learned in my clinic is that, almost similar to the other targeted agents, that there are situations where there is discordant response where patients will progress in one area. And for those patients, I continue to treat through and would do a focal therapy in that area where they're progressing, whether it be radiation or a focal surgical procedure.
What's a typical location when that happens?
Mostly bone or lung.
Interesting.
So we've had patients who would be classified as progressors if they were on a clinical trial with a progression in one target lung lesion, and we have radiated that lung lesion and continued to treat patients through, and have patients who have done well for many years with metastatic basal cell carcinoma.
What about beyond vismodegib? Are there any non-protocol options, and what are some of the trial concepts, if any, that are available to patients like that?
So beyond vismodegib, there are other inhibitors downstream in this pathway that are being looked at in single agent or combination. One of the more interesting things beyond vismodegib are hedgehog inhibitors that are topical formulations that have been looked at without major success at this point, but it's clearly a field that's moving forward.
That's really interesting. Have any objective responses been seen?
Some, but not significant. One of the initial formulations of this drug was also a topical.
So you brought in a case of basal cell from your practice. Can you present what happened with this woman?
So we were referred a patient who is a female in her 50s with significant evidence of metastatic disease in the lungs. She had some cough and some irritation.
What was her history in terms of the primary?
She had had multiple basal cell carcinomas resected in the past.
And had any of these sort of gotten out of local control or been delayed?
No.
Just regular basal cells?
Right. So what's interesting and a point that you made before is that this isn't really a situation where these tumors would recur locally with significant lymphadenopathy and then move from a locally advanced situation to a metastatic situation. That's been very rare for our experience at the Angeles Clinic. Most patients are referred with the diagnosis of metastatic disease, and the history is of bony pain and then extensive metastatic disease with a worsening in patient's performance status due to their pulmonary status or the bone metastases.
What was this lady's clinical situation when you first saw her? You know, did she have symptoms from the disease, and where exactly was it?
She had diffuse lung metastases that were significant, and they were progressing. We had the ability to have two CAT scans that were a certain time away to see that this was progressing. So we immediately started her on treatment, and I think she was one of the patients that was on the Aravance trial. She immediately had response, with some of her lung lesions completely resolving and others shrinking more than 50%.
Did she have symptoms from the disease?
Just cough and some mild shortness of breath.
And did that get better with treatment?
Absolutely. What also happened during treatment is that she had the side effects of alopecia. She had a mild taste change on and off during her therapy. She's had some diarrhea, which can be a side effect of this drug, and hyponatremia. So electrolyte abnormalities can be seen. Ultimately, while on study, she had a great response, continued on the drug, and had a discordant growth of one lesion. And we sent her for a focal stereotactic radiosurgery to that lesion, and she remains in good control and has been followed by us for 3 years now.
Wow.
Doing well.
So this was a pulmonary lesion that was radiated?
Yes.
You mentioned hyponatremia and electrolyte abnormalities. What's the pathophysiology and what do you do about it?
Pathophysiology, unknown. What I do about it is I would give them a break, allow the electrolytes to improve, and then I restarted her on the drug, and she hasn't had those problems going forward.
Interesting. You mentioned alopecia. Is this generally complete?
It's complete. The experience has been that once off of the drug, that these patients have a return of their hair growth. What's been my experience is that I've had a couple of patients whose hair has not come back, and I don't understand why that is, and have had some where their hair comes back very less of what they've had before. I think there should be a point made about this drug also, that it's a great, great drug, but it's highly teratogenic. This is a very highly teratogenic drug. This is a drug that targets a pathway that's important and is turned on in embryological development and then is shut off in all cells and is important in healing. But this drug comes and was found based on these cycloptic sheep that were grazing. And then they found the drug based on working backwards from this. So when I have patients who are started on this, it's important to note that two forms of contraception are important. And then after discontinuation, contraception is important in the male who's been taking the drug for at least 2 months and in the female for 7 months after discontinuation.
Is there like an FDA registration kind of thing in that regard?
No. So that harkens us back to the days of trying to give thalidomide
right.
for treatment.
And even lenalidomide today.
Oh, yes, but no, not for this drug.
Wow. Interesting.
I think what's most important about basal cell these days is it's become a multidisciplinary care diagnosis where the surgical oncologist and the medical oncologist and radiation oncologist have to work in concert for optimal outcomes. And in the past, it had been initially a dermatological issue, and then on recurrence, maybe the patient sees a radiation oncologist, and then on local recurrence that's unresectable, they see a surgeon. And then ultimately, when things get out of hand and there's diffuse metastatic disease or deformative disease, then a medical oncologist would become involved. At this point, when you have a recurrent basal cell carcinoma, it is a time for the involvement of a multidisciplinary team of radiation oncology and medical oncology.
So let's move over and spend the rest of our time talking about melanoma and particular management of BRAF positive advanced disease.
Okay, so this data has all come forward in the last 5 or so years, but has really taken force based on the initial data from vemurafenib, the phase 1 data that was presented in the New England Journal by Flaherty, and the phase 2 trial data presented by Sossman, and then ultimately the randomized trial presented by Paul Chapman and others, looking at it in comparison with dacarbazine, showing improvements in overall survival and improvements in duration of response progression-free survival. What we have initially seen, which was unbelievable and amazing, that in these population of patients, and what I would say is this mutation exists in about 50% of cutaneous melanomas. It does occur in mucosal melanomas, but in a very lesser frequency. It does not occur in ocular melanomas. There's been some data reported that in iris primary oculars that this BRAF mutation may exist, but otherwise not. What we have seen is with this drug, there are high response rates and high levels of clinical benefit, about 70%. There is a Lazarus response in that these patients are started and their disease begins to melt away within 48 to 72 hours. Their performance status improves significantly in a rapid fashion. And what we had seen is that just as wonderful as this initial response is, when these patients become resistant to BRAF inhibition, their disease begins to progress in the same areas and can become aggressive. As the data has moved forward, we've had a second BRAF inhibitor, dabrafenib, approved by the FDA based on a similar randomized study. And afterwards, we've understood that dual pathway inhibition, that is the pathway that we are inhibiting that goes RAS, RAF, MEK, ERK, so this cascade, the MEK inhibition and BRAF inhibition in combination has been shown to have not only higher rates of clinical benefit, higher response rates, but a improved progression-free survival and the possibility of improved overall survival. At the time that we're taping this, there have been 3 randomized trials looking at dual inhibition with BRAF and MEK inhibitors versus BRAF inhibition alone. The first of those was presented initially at ASCO 2014, which was dabrafenib and trametinib versus dabrafenib alone in the COMBI-D trial. And initially, the progression-free survival, while significant, was minimally better. We're looking at the overall survival data to come forward. And the reason we see this is that the initial data that was presented from a smaller trial looking at combinatorial dabrafenib and trametinib versus dabrafenib showed that in the combination arm, the median survivals were about 25 months, and these are amazing numbers. And the progression-free survival was over 11 months. What has come forth since has been data on the trial COMBI-V, which was dabrafenib and trametinib versus vemurafenib. And the initial release that's come from GSK has noted that there is a overall survival advantage.
What about the issue of toxicity with these agents and combinations?
There is some indication that there is less toxicity. I know that goes against what you would initially think, but there is a possibility of less toxicity with the combination versus single agent as far as squamous cell carcinomas, and other toxicities that are seen in only single-agent BRAF inhibition.
Sunburn?
The photosensitivity also, yes. And even between the two BRAF inhibitors alone, there may be differences in incidence of photosensitivity where dabrafenib may have less of an incidence but has other toxicities. And we can talk about those. My gist is that dual inhibition of that BRAF pathway is going to show improved progression-free survival and the possibility of improved overall survival. It should be and will become a standard.
What about outside a trial setting? What are you doing nowadays?
Outside a trial setting, the standard for us is looking and deciding on, based on the toxicities that you can see, what is the right BRAF inhibitor and availability doing combinatorial BRAF and MEK inhibition.
So does that mean you actually are doing it outside a trial setting?
Absolutely. This has been approved by the FDA as BRAF and MEK inhibition together. The clarity and the true benefits will let us know if this is going to move and be the standard for inhibitor therapy in BRAF mutant melanoma.
What do we know about single agent activity with MEK inhibitors, and is there a role for that at all?
Absolutely. This data was presented and it was ultimately published in the New England Journal with just trametinib alone versus dacarbazine in metastatic melanoma. What we know is that the progression-free survival and the response rates are less than with just BRAF inhibitor alone. So what does that mean? Well, in my opinion, what that means is that if you have a patient who cannot tolerate a BRAF inhibitor, possibly secondary to its toxicity of photosensitivity or its toxicity of renal insufficiency or QT prolongation, if you cannot target the BRAF pathway with a BRAF inhibitor or with combinatorial therapy, then a single agent MEK inhibitor alone is a therapeutic with survival advantage. It's been proven in a randomized clinical trial, and therefore it is an option for our patients.
What's the role currently of vemurafenib?
So vemurafenib is the first BRAF inhibitor that's approved by the FDA. It is the most commonly used BRAF inhibitor, and it's the most commonly given one in single agent. I think that's the role. In the future, as the combination trial data is presented, its role in dual inhibition will move forward. We've presented the initial phase 2 data from BRIM7 showing a greater clinical benefit and possibly an improvement in progression-free survival. And what we are waiting for is the combination trial data to be presented to know more.
What's your take right now on some of the key differentiating points in terms of side effects? What is the toxicity profile, the things that you generally expect with vemurafenib, with dabrafenib, and the two combinations?
So with vemurafenib, of course, there are significant toxicities that every oncologist should be aware of. When we start patients, we point towards the QT prolongation, and therefore they need a EKG before beginning, 2 weeks into therapy, a month into therapy, and then with less frequently to evaluate for QT prolongation. You also know that there is the incidence of photosensitivity, which is about 30%. So we speak to each one of our patients about sun avoidance and those issues, as these can, if not noted, can become significant. There's an incidence of rash that can proceed to be a total body rash and be significant.
You mentioned sun sensitivity, and I've heard some really scary stories about sunburn. How meticulous do you counsel patients?
We spent an extensive period of time talking to them about truly wearing the hats, the covering up. We've had patients who've been out and can feel the burn. So we mentioned to them, although the incidences in the clinical trials were about 30%, that they need to wear chapstick, sunscreen, reapply, try not to be out in the sun too long, and go from there. The incidence of squamous cell carcinomas because of activation of RAS pathways is important, and these patients do see dermatologists during their time on these BRAF inhibitors. BRAF inhibition can cause decrements in renal function, and they can also cause some changes in heme parameters, especially thrombocytopenia and anemia. So we watch these on those patients. Now, the other BRAF inhibitor, dabrafenib, is noted to have possibly a lower incidence of squamous cell carcinomas and less photosensitivity. I would point that these are not head-to-head comparisons, and the trials had different assessments done. Some trials did not have full dermatological assessments, but what is out there is that maybe the incidence of photosensitivity may be less, or the incidence of squamous cell carcinomas. So some physicians are choosing that for their patients who have those risks, although with dabrafenib and also with the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib, what we've seen are greater incidence of arthritis, joint pains, and a greater incidence of fever, pyrexia. And these pyrexia episodes are not insignificant. They're temperatures in the 101s, 102s. So you can see that that's something that we as initial investigators will have to do better to educate our colleagues on how to manage these symptoms and what to look for.
How do you approach the patient who's presenting with metastatic disease, BRAF positive, in terms of whether to go with BRAF inhibition with or without a MEK inhibitor versus immunotherapy?
Right. So at a research institute like ours, we would try and get them onto a treatment that has the combination of targeted and immunotherapy. While I understand that that's not available to the majority of patients who are BRAF mutated and who are in the community, my belief is that that will become a gold standard, hopefully shortly, given the number of trials that are looking at the ability to combine these together.
As long as you brought that up, what data do we have on that question so far?
So there's lots of data on there. The initial foray into this with vemurafenib and ipilimumab was stopped due to significant hepatotoxicity. And that was published as a letter to the editor in New England Journal from Rebus, Wolchuk, and others. And then moving forward, just as far as with ipilimumab, there's been a trial that was presented. Initial data was presented by Igor Puzanov from Vanderbilt, and we were part of this trial that looked at dabrafenib and ipilimumab, and another arm had dabrafenib, trametinib, and ipilimumab. So the triplet arm was stopped early because of a significant proportion of colitis. Actually, there were two perforations. And what that teaches us is that maybe we have to find the right combinations to go greater than two drugs together. What that also teaches us is it's not ready for prime time. Despite the fact that these three drugs are available in the community, without the right clinical trial data, they should not be combined with the intent of patient benefit, because what we've shown is that it's significantly toxic. But the combination of dabrafenib and ipilimumab has been tolerable and is moving forward and will be updated in upcoming meetings. The next field will be looking at these targeted therapies with PD-1 and PD-L1 targeted agents, so the next generation of checkpoint inhibitors. And we presented the initial data of the vemurafenib with the Genentech PD-L1 drug and noted that it's tolerable without significant toxicities, and that trial is ongoing.
What about efficacy in that trial?
The initial data presented was only on three patients where we saw responses in all three, but the long-term benefit here is getting the idea of initial clinical response and progression-free survival advantage that the targeted therapies give, and translating that into a greater percentage of patients benefiting with the long-term survival benefit that checkpoint inhibitors give, and moving the survival curve up.
But your prediction slash hope that this is where we're going to be in the future, is that based more on sort of biology and hope, or is there data out there that makes you feel that way?
There's data out there that makes me hopeful that this will be there. Let me give you an example, and maybe this will be a good transition into the idea of immunotherapies and checkpoint inhibition. When the initial trial, the randomized trial looking at the benefits of ipilimumab and metastatic melanoma was done and presented ultimately, what we showed, and this is Hody et al. In the New England Journal of Medicine led to the approval of ipilimumab as a standard is that ipilimumab improved the one-year survival from about 25% to 46%, and the two-year survival improved to about 24-25%. That data and all the data with ipilimumab trials has been updated by Dr. Hody at ESMO and will be published soon, showing 10-year survivals above 20% for these patients. So what we're looking at is something where 10-year survivals were under 10%, now 20%. One-year survivals, which is what I'll use to move forward, went from 25 to 46%. Now, with the most recent data that has been presented at ASCO with single-agent inhibition of PD-1, whether it's looking at the pembrolizumab data or the nivolumab data, you're looking at one-year survivals over 60%. And I'm going to point to the fact that a lot of patients, the pembrolizumab data is based on a little over 400 patients. So now you're going from 1 year, 25 to 46, to above 60%. Then Marius Knoll and colleagues presented an update of the data that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine by Jed Wolchuk on combination, so dual checkpoint inhibition with ipilimumab and nivolumab. And granted, this is again a smaller subset of patients, but one-year survival is greater than 80%. So that's what I hang my hat on. That and the understanding that we do have some early morbidity and mortality due to tumor growth kinetics that targeted therapies can abrogate. And so clearly the field has taken this forward. The idea and the trials that we are bringing to our patients no longer look at single agents. They are combinations of PD-1 and PD-L1 targeted agents with other targets or with each other. We have a PD-L1 and PD-1 combinatorial trial. There are trials looking at dual inhibition of BRAF and MEK with checkpoint inhibition. And hopefully this will move the field forward and survival benefit will come from that. I should point out that what we are also seeing is the ability of the companies that have these drugs to allow us to understand how we are benefiting patients and who the right patients are to benefit. Every single trial now that is coming forward is looking at prognostic and predictive biomarkers. And that's the buzzword. What is in the tumor microenvironment? What is in the genetic makeup of the tumor? What is in there, not just at initial, but in real time as treatment progresses? How does the immune system ramp up or ramp down to give us an understanding of who are the patients that are responding or will respond or will benefit? So hopefully we can make decisions to discontinue therapy earlier or to offer a better therapy initially. And that's where the field is moving. And I do think that combination therapy will be a standard. And my hope is that we can avoid some of the toxicities that may come when you combine therapies by understanding through biomarker data who are the patients that don't need it. And interestingly, we haven't been as diligent as we needed to be in the past with the development of other checkpoint inhibitors or other targeted agents, and we are now.
In terms of non-protocol management, if doc in community practice or a patient doesn't want to be part of a protocol, what's your approach in terms of first-line therapy and metastatic disease in terms of BRAF-positive disease? Do you start with a BRAF inhibitor? Do you start with the immunotherapy? How do you make that decision?
I make that decision based on the number one thought is morbidity, what the patient's status is. I alluded to it before. The idea that these targeted agents are rapid, they can give rapid benefit in progression-free survival. They can give rapid benefit in patients' performance status. And we've seen patients who have significant decrements in their performance status improve within the first week of treatment with these targeted agents. As far as moving forward, the ideal that immune therapies, which include the checkpoint inhibitors, they include high-dose interleukin-2, which is still an option, The fact that these are the therapies that have tail of the curve and survival advantage, we have the discussion about the ability to see this either initially or sometime during their care in order to achieve that long-term benefit.
So in general, for a patient who's asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic, do you start out with a BRAF inhibitor or a combination or, you know, immunotherapy?
Well, we have an immunotherapeutic bent here. The understanding of whether patients with low volume disease may benefit similarly to targeted inhibition with long-term survival that has yet to be presented and may possibly be there. But for minimally symptomatic patients, we treat with immunotherapy as first line.